allowing the linkage of appropriations with such contingency language eviscerates the line item veto authority vested in the governor.
The state attorney general says a Senate budget bill could be headed to the courts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a polar bear cub is on its way to Anchorage.
There's a lot we don't know about how cubs become orphaned, but it is something that happens in nature.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. Pen Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at penair.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Members of the House Finance Committee met in Anchorage today to hear the State Department of Law's opinion regarding language in a Senate budget bill. As it stands now, the state legislature is still in special session because of an impasse between the Senate and Governor Sean Parnell over language, which in essence forces the governor to pass all or none of 105 capital projects in the bill. State Attorney General John Burns told the Finance Committee members that Section 36, the contingency clause of the bill, is, in his opinion, unconstitutional.
Section 36 seeks to link together approximately 105 separate and distinct projects, comprising an estimated $404 million in total spending, and requires the enactment of all or none of those projects without reduction. This condition is unconstitutional and unenforceable because it deprives the governor of his constitutional authority to reduce or strike individual appropriation items.
Burns told the panel that the Senate's approach to the capital projects is a first in Alaska's history. He also warned the committee members that another clause in the bill, Section 37, should be removed from it.
Section 37 exacerbates this constitutional violation by, in essence, doubling the constitutional linkage of these various energy projects. Through the inclusion of what's been called the non-severability language, the legislature attempts to achieve the same result through a different means. As drafted, Section 37 provides that if the contingency language of 36 is held to be invalid, all the appropriation items in Section 4 become invalid as well.
Finance Committee member Anna Faircloth said after the session adjourned that the focus on the validity of energy projects coming out of the debate is not the real issue.
What I'd like to hear all of Alaskans discuss is the constitutionality issue of a contingency clause with a non-severability clause that links so many projects together. So I am getting frustrated that we talk about the sound bites that each group may be trying to say to support their positions, but the real issue for most of the people that I talk to is indeed just the unconstitutional position that it seems to be making.
Representative Les Guerra says he'd like to see the governor sit down with Senate members and assure them that their projects won't be vetoed. A polar bear cub is expected to arrive in Anchorage this evening after Fish and Wildlife officials determined that it was orphaned. Fish and Wildlife was informed about the cub by ConocoPhillips after it was observed on the Alpine Field on the western edge of Prudhoe Bay. According to Rosa Meehan, supervisor of the Marine Mammal Program for Fish and Wildlife in Alaska, officials were able to verify that the female cub, that's about 4 months old, was indeed an orphan before they captured it.
We did some aerial surveys. The company did aerial surveys. And we did not pick up the cub until after we did that, and it actually had been 24 hours that the cub had been first spotted before we started the whole process to capture it.
Meehan says the fate of the mother is not currently known and that a number of things could have contributed to her disappearance.
There's a lot we don't know about how cubs become orphaned, but it is something that happens in nature, and we don't have any reason to think it was anything other than a natural event.
It has not been decided where the cub will be staying in the future, but for now, it will reside at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. The cub will be fed Esbalac, a commercial puppy milk replacement, boosted by heavy cream for the high-fat needs of a polar bear diet. According to Meehan, the one place it will not end up, however, is back in the wild. An ice avalanche killed a climber near the Ruth Gorge in the Alaska Range early Thursday morning. It's the first climbing death of the season. Those involved in the accident and those that climb on the Ruth Glacier on a regular basis are examining the event and wonder what could have been done differently. KTNA's Sue Dio has more.
The Alaska Range has had its first death of the climbing season. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning when a large serac, a column of ice, let loose high above a camp near the Moose's Tooth in the Alaska Range. The 10,300-foot-tall Moose's Tooth is one of the most popular climbing areas near the Ruth Gorge. Two separate climbing parties, both guided by professionals, were camped overnight to the south on a glacier landing strip called the Root Canal. Colby Coombs is a climber, guide, and owner of Alaska Mountaineering School and describes what he has been told was a disastrous event.
Yeah, it was very violent and, you know, scary. These guys are planning on climbing in a couple hours. They're getting shut-eye. And they all talked about hearing a big crack, boom, and literally 10 seconds later, it was completely out of control.
Todd Rutledge owns Mountain Trip, the Colorado-based professional guiding company. He echoes what Coombs says.
It sounded like the tent was lifted up and the floor blown out of the tent, and the climbers shot out through the floor and then just covered in snow. And I know at least one climber lost a boot or two, and they spent the rest of the night with very minimal supplies and gear.
Coombs explains that the avalanche wasn't the kind that most people in general are familiar with.
This was a serac fall avalanche. It's as similar as like an iceberg peeling off into the water, except it's a glacier that's on a steep, rocky face up in the mountains. And when the chunks of ice are released, there's no telling where they're going to go. They can bounce in completely opposite directions than a normal slab avalanche where there's a debris path and it flows out in front. It's pretty predictable where a slab's going to end up.
The Alaska Earthquake Information Center reported a very small earthquake, magnitude 1.96, along the Alaska Range, a few miles to the west of the Ruth Glacier at 12:58 a.m., just a minute or two before the event. A 911 satellite phone call was made as soon as the climbers unburied themselves and found one of their fellow climbers was severely injured. Helicopters were unable to launch in the dark, but everything was prepared for daybreak. Rutledge says the focus switched completely to the only injured party in the two groups.
Once it was determined that there was one primary injury amongst the group, the focus became on doing everything possible to help him.
It was during the flight that rescuers determined the climber had died from his injuries. The medics on the Aeromed helicopter confirmed the death when the two helicopters met at the staging location. The other climbers were flown off the mountain and back to Talkeetna. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a shakeup on the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Panel.
It just created a conflict that we just couldn't resolve.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Concern over the autonomy of scientists on the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Science Panel has prompted NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service to remove the two panel members who work for the state of Alaska. The issue arose in January when Commissioner Cora Campbell wrote to NIMS saying, despite the terms of reference laid out by NIMS, stating scientists must serve on the panel independent of their respective agencies, ADF&G scientists would adhere to department policies and not act independently. Doug Meekham is Deputy Administrator for NOAA Fisheries in Alaska. He says the state's scientists were taken off the panel last week.
Because the state made it clear, both you had conversations with them as well as in correspondence, that their scientists were there to participate fully, but they also were expected to represent the positions of the department. And, of course, the department has obviously stated, and the state of Alaska has demonstrated, that they don't believe that the Cook Inlet Beluga population should be listed in the first place. And so that just created a conflict that we just couldn't resolve.
Meekham says NIMS did, however, make a change in how the science panel will conduct their meetings. Initially, panel members were to meet privately and then release their information to the other panel working on Cook Inlet Beluga recovery, the stakeholders panel that represents oil and gas industry members, conservation groups, and the state of Alaska. Now, Meekham says the science panel meetings will be open to the stakeholder group. He says partially it's a compromise.
It was in large part because of concerns expressed by the state that they would, you know, they thought we needed to be a little bit more open with the science panel process. So rather than have the science panel meetings conducted for 2 days and that are not open and then get together and talk, they'd like to listen to the proceedings as they're occurring.
It's not yet been decided how that participation will be managed. Doug Vincent Lang is Deputy Commissioner for the state's Fish and Game Department and also the Endangered Species Coordinator for the state. He says the decision to remove the state's scientists is disappointing.
We had hoped that we could bring the collective experience of the department to, you know, to inform the development of this plan, and we're just somewhat saddened that National Marine Fisheries Service and the rest of the science panel didn't see the benefit of that collective wisdom coming forward to inform the development. But, you know, that said, we're not going to stop from participating in the process. We're going to continue to participate in that process to the best of our ability with the tools that we're given and the avenues we're given.
Craig Matkin is on the science panel representing the North Gulf Oceanic Society. He says it's unfortunate the state scientists had to go because they had valuable information that now leaves a vacuum, but he's concerned about opening the meetings up to the stakeholders.
I'm concerned that if this is becomes too much of an open process, it will become politicized, and the whole point of the best science being representative and put down in the initial plan won't be there. And so it's looking like it's going to get more and more complicated, and I'm afraid possibly less productive.
Matkin says as the members figure out how to proceed, the recovery plan for belugas that hover at precariously low numbers is not moving forward.
It's very unfortunate for the belugas, and not only for the belugas, but for people that want to do particular things in Cook Inlet, that we aren't going to have a clear roadmap here for some time.
The science panel's most recent scheduled meeting was canceled because of concerns over the prospect of a government shutdown. It's not known when the next meeting will be scheduled. The state's redistricting board is wrestling with changing the voting district map to match this decade's census figures. But other groups are submitting alternative plans of their own. And as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, three statewide scenarios are competing for public attention.
Vince Beltrami is a union official by vocation and something of a political activist. He's one of the faces behind a civic group called Alaskans for Fair Redistricting, which has submitted its own plan to the state redistricting board.
I mean, certainly it's important to preserve the voice of rural Alaska. And it's also important, I think, in the urban areas to make sure that the districts that are designed are neighborhood-based districts, that people in the same districts have things in common, you know, socioeconomically and otherwise.
AFFR's plan is backed by several Alaska Native corporations, according to its organizers. AFFR's Vicky Otte says 10 years ago, it was AFFR's balanced redistricting plan that was upheld by the courts.
Well, if you look at what we have today in our legislature, you have a Senate that is made up of 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats. I believe that's a fair and balanced legislature. You look at the House, it is almost just as equal.
Beltrami says AFFR's plan guards against gerrymandering, or the practice of manipulating voting district lines to favor one party. AFFR's plan keeps the North Slope as it is now and draws two statewide rural districts stretching ribbon-like from the state's eastern boundary with Canada to the Bering Sea. AFFR's Carl Mars says the 2001 district map gives the Bush caucus some power. Mars says more recent shifts in population could skew Alaska Native representation in Juneau. Under the Federal Voting Rights Act, the state redistricting effort must preserve minority voting strength, and State Department of Justice rules forbid retrogression of the number of minority voting districts unless it is, quote, unavoidable. With rural populations declining, that has become redistricting's challenge.
Anchorage is one of the newest communities in Alaska, yet now it's the largest. Its population is the newest to Alaska, and yet rural Alaska tends to be left out in the cold. If you look at it from a dollar resource standpoint, the 90% of the money, if not more, that's made for the state coffers comes out of rural Alaska.
AFFR is concerned that 4 out of the 5 appointed state redistricting board members are Republicans. Only one is a Democrat. Republican Party of Alaska Chair Randy Riedrich says he's only a volunteer working for another group with an alternative redistricting plan, the similarly named Alaskans for Fair and Equitable Redistricting. Riedrich spoke in favor of the AFFER's plan at a recent redistricting board public hearing.
I encourage the board to consider the Alaskans for Fair and Equitable Redistricting plan and map, which does consider the major creeks, roads, assembly sections, and community councils in Anchorage, and uses similar factors throughout the state.
Friedrich says the AFFER plan is still undergoing some fine-tuning, but in essence it keeps the Alaska Native influence districts and the majority minority districts. It creates a Native influence voting district in Southeast.
To build a voting rights district so that Alaska Natives have an opportunity to still influence the election of one House rep.
AFFER's plan follows Anchorage Assembly boundaries for state election districts, he says. A third plan, the Rights Coalition plan, is endorsed by the Democratic Party of Alaska. Rights Coalition spokesman Leonard Lawson says the builders of the rights map started with the numbers from 10 years ago.
So we've made sure that we hit each of the important numbers for percentages for influence district and majority-minority districts from 10 years ago. All across the board, we have tried to stay within the bounds and avoid retrogression by having the exact same number of districts as the current plan does when it was drawn.
Lawson says the rights plan is nonpartisan and not a move to create another progressive district. It does respect borough and city boundaries and keeps existing districts where it makes sense, he says. And Lawson says it keeps House districts contiguous, unlike some aspects of the redistricting board's plan.
We're not sure whether or not it's constitutional to have non-contiguous House districts. If you take a House district from over here and you pair it with another House district over there, are they still getting their same voice, especially in the Senate, that they deserve?
The State Redistricting Board does not endorse any of the alternative plans. The Redistricting Board is holding public hearings in small communities throughout the state this week and next. A statewide public hearing is set for May 6th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A new telephone survey, especially for women, is being conducted in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and the Dillingham area. Its results could have a big impact on how regional and state programs address two of Alaska's most persistent and terrible social issues, domestic violence and sexual assault. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Hello, I'm calling on behalf of the College of Health and Social Welfare at the University of Alaska. The College of Health and Social Welfare is doing a research study on health, injuries, and relationships.
That's the introduction to a survey about domestic and sexual violence. And it's something women in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau, as well as the Dillingham area, can expect to hear over the next couple of months when they pick up the telephone. It's called a victimization survey, and it takes a half an hour. It's being conducted by University of Alaska Anchorage researchers. UAA conducted a statewide victimization survey earlier this year. It found nearly 60% of Alaska women will experience intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both at some point in their lifetime.
You get in a room anytime that you think about you're in a movie theater or you're in a restaurant or any place in Alaska and you look around, if you got 100 women in the room, you know, just think about the fact that 60 of them have been beaten or raped or assaulted or abused by an intimate partner in their lifetime. This is a pretty near universal experience with women in Alaska.
That's Ginger Baim with Safe Domestic Violence Center in Dillingham. The Bristol Bay region was selected for the regional survey after the State Department of Health and Social Services awarded a $416,000 grant to SAFE to stop domestic violence in Bristol Bay earlier this year. Baim says a statewide survey was important, but it had flaws.
Those numbers, they included women in home in the evening with a landline. What it didn't include were women in shelter, women in very rural areas of the state. As awful as the numbers were, we have good reason to believe that those are pretty conservative numbers. We're assuming that domestic violence and sexual assault numbers are much higher in the bush, and that's primarily because we know that they're much higher among Alaska Native women.
National surveys show that victimization rates are higher among American Indians and Alaska Natives than any other racial or ethnic group. UAA researcher Dr. Andre Rosé.
We know that there are very high rates of victimization, but we actually don't have the data to substantiate that. We know that there are lots of reports to law enforcement, but what we don't know is how many offenses are actually occurring and how many of those are not reported to law enforcement.
Rosé says the Bristol Bay survey will give researchers the first scientific snapshot of the situation with domestic violence and sexual assault in the Bristol Bay region.
So what this survey will do is it will provide the first, most thorough image of the true extent of victimization in the Dillingham area. We are also establishing a baseline with the survey so that we can see the impact that the governor's initiative to end the epidemic of domestic violence and sexual assault will have on the Dillingham region.
The survey includes the entire Dillingham census area, the Bristol Bay Borough, as well as the Lake and Peninsula Borough. The survey started this week, and it runs for the next 2 months. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In Alaska, amateur radio operators have played a critical role responding to disasters. After the 1964 earthquake, phone lines were down. People in Anchorage had no way of communicating with Homer, Seward, or Kodiak to see if the towns had survived. It was amateur radio operators who reestablished contact, reporting back that the towns were not gone, just badly damaged. Since then, members of Alaska's Amateur Radio Emergency Service have built up more resources to respond to disasters. APRN's Josh Tucker reports.
A 50-foot-long RV, overflowing with radio equipment, roars to life as Michael O'Keefe eases it out of the firehouse-style garage in the Anchorage Amateur Radio Clubhouse.
The whole purpose of this vehicle is to provide emergency communication to any agency that wants it if their primary source of communications capability fails. In the back here, we have a marine band radio, which allows us to talk to the United States Coast Guard. We have an aircraft radio over here in the corner.
Every week, O'Keefe runs a meeting of the region's Amateur Radio Emergency Service. The meeting's on the airwaves. Tonight, the operators are calling in from their handheld radios to test their network's ability to connect to the RV and Anchorage's Emergency Operations Center on their handhelds. that can be as cheap as $89.
I'd like to ask now if there's any emergency or priority traffic. If there is, please come now. Amateur Radio Emergency Services Net, KL7BX, Dave in Anchorage.
KL7BX on the handheld in the living room.
O'Keefe is a master sergeant in Alaska's Air National Guard. More than 50 people called in when he tested the amateur radio emergency service.
Robert in Kenai.
Hey, good evening there, Mike, and everybody on net. AL2B in Kenai.
Amateur radio can connect Alaskans with the information they need to help one another, especially in rural areas.
There's amateur radio all over the state of Alaska. We use the amateur radio for search and rescue in all of the native villages. Anyone on a snow machine or on a boat can take a handheld radio and communicate so they can relay any type of emergency traffic. The amateur radio provides a unique service which frees up any federal, state, or municipal organization.
When O'Keefe and his wife Kathy taught the latest amateur radio class at the Anchorage Emergency Operations Center in early April, they had more than 50 students. O'Keefe says the number of students more than doubled from the last class they taught before the earthquake in Japan.
We're trying to get more people involved. We're trying to get more people in the classes. It's all about, you know, getting prepared for the disaster if and when it happens.
As part of Anchorage's emergency operations plan, amateur radio operators are trained to provide communications to hospitals and emergency shelters during a disaster. O'Keefe says his students come from a wide variety of backgrounds, including the city's police and fire departments. Anchorage stay-at-home mom Jennifer Sherwin took the O'Keefe's latest class. She says it was helpful.
It's definitely something you can get into. You know, I'm not going to go blow the family budget this week on a huge antenna array or setting up a mobile command center, but I just wanted to know how it works, and I wanted to be a part of it, not on the outside. And you never know if you're the one who's going to be in a position to help. If you've prepared, then you can respond.
Anchorage has not always included amateur radio in its disaster planning, but Dawn Brantley, the community outreach coordinator for the city's Office of Emergency Management, says amateur or ham radio plays a vital role.
If you come to the Emergency Operations Center, every desk has a radio. And that's because you can't always count on landlines and you can't always count on cell phones. Ham radios are the most reliable form of communications. And what I saw was a need to put this out to the different emergency watch programs. So emergency watch programs have a communication team. And one requirement is that at least one person, preferably two, have a ham radio license.
A city can't be prepared for disaster without prepared citizens, says Brantley. O'Keefe and other amateur radio operators have been engineering their backup plans just in case. For APRN, this is Joshua Tucker.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Dacia Eaton in Dillingham. APRN's Josh Edge and Josh Tucker reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
The Medallion Foundation, with safety training programs and 16 flight simulators statewide, supports the Alaska Airmen's Association trade show and convention on April 30th and May 1st at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. There'll be a full-motion Super Cub simulator for demonstration to the aviation public. The Medallion Foundation, changing the culture of flight safety. For more information, go to medallionfoundation.org. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.